When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddow, and wherever you're listening from, it's great to have you with us. I hope you've enjoyed the latest series. And if you're new to Book Off, well, all our episodes are available to listen to for free whenever you want. And some of the brilliant guests who have joined us just on Series 9 include Monica Ali, Marion Keyes, David Baldacci, Charlotte Mendelssohn, Ardal O'Hanlon, Liz Hyder, Jarvis Cocker, Nina Stibbe, Carrie Hope Fletcher, and the Reverend Richard Coles, to name but a few. And for our last episode, our very last episode of this series, I'm joined by two more fabulous humans and writers. And my first guest started writing when he was 10. He was a singer, a painter and decorator, I don't think together, before he started writing for TV, where he went on to create the hugely successful comedy series, The Far Show. Hello, Ted. He is the author of the best-selling Young Bond books and the very successful horror series, The Enemy, and he's here to tell us about his new adult crime novel, Whatever Gets You Through the Night. It's Charlie Hickson. Hello.
Hello there.
Lovely to see you. And my sober this time, that's me, not you. And my second guest is a screenwriter and author who, after writing a couple of successful film scripts, moved back to the UK to study psychotherapy. Before giving up writing for good, he gave it one last go, penning a detective novel called The Silent Patient, which went on to become an international bestseller. Here to tell us about his second novel, The Maidens, it's Alec Michaelides. Hello!
Hello, hiya.
Lovely to have you both here in person, in the studio. And I know we've sort of met off mic, but Charlie, Alex, Alex, Charlie. Introductions
Hello.
Are done.
Marvellous.
And for the next 40 minutes or so, we're going to talk about your books, your writing, your inspirations. You're going to give us some book recommendations, and we're going to do the book off as well, of course, towards the end of the podcast. But let's talk firstly about The Maidens, if I may, Alex. Now, I've read quite a bit over the last couple of weeks of you talking about this book, and you fell in love with classic thrillers when you were living in Greece, when you were younger, didn't you? And that is sort of a bit of the spark for this book.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I think partly it was because I wrote it during lockdown. And so I think I was feeling a little bit nostalgic for, I don't know, for the past, when I was kind of locked in my flat. And I grew up in Cyprus, and I suppose what made me into a reader and a writer was discovering Agatha Christie at the age of 13, and then just devouring all of her novels on the beach in Cyprus. And it was kind of the happiest reading experience I ever had. And so, you know, before I gave up writing, I thought I want to try and just try a detective story, because I've always wanted to. And it kind of went from there. And then with The Maidens, it was very much like a very conscious attempt to try and write a kind of homage to that kind of classic detective story. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wrote it as a fan, I suppose, of the genre, really.
Yeah, which is a good way to approach a book, really, isn't it? I suppose, come as a fan. And Charlie, you've been writing for years and years and years, but it's not since the late 90s that there was an adult fiction book from you?
Early 90s.
Gosh, yeah.
I wrote four adult crime books in the early 90s. And I remember I was desperately trying to finish the fourth one just before my second son was born and just before we were going to do the first series of The Fast Show. So I needed to get it out of the way. And then I haven't had time since to follow it up.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's interesting because my crime book I wrote was that's just out. I also wrote in lockdown. Where is yours set?
It's set in Cambridge.
Oh, right. Yeah. So mine's set in Corfu. So were you in Cyprus dreaming of Cambridge while I was London dreaming of Corfu?
Yeah, right, I was in London actually too, but at that time. But yes, it's funny, none of us wanted to be where we actually were, I think. Yeah.
And did it have an effect on the writing, not just the setting, but writing it in that weird sort of isolation we were all in? Did that actually affect the plot in any way or the way that you wrote these books?
Well, I found, like a lot of people, very hard to concentrate at the beginning of lockdown. Couldn't read much, couldn't do any serious writing. I did lots of bits and pieces. Mm. But then as it went on and summer hit and then we went sort of towards the second lockdown, I felt a sort of great pressure building up inside of me. I wanted to do something and do something a bit bigger. Mm. So it kind of came splurging out for me.
And was it in my case, it's very much about, you know, trying to conjure up that place, very much like an effort of, you know, being somewhere else, somewhere kind of...
Well, it was, particularly for me, because Corfu was one of the places I always used to go on holiday as a teenager and then when the kids were small. And, you know, I couldn't get there. And I'd always wanted to write something set there. And it just felt right to put myself there.
Mm-hmm. I relate to that. With me, The Maidens, it was about... I guess I've always wanted to write about Cambridge since I was a student there. And because I've always loved it. It's such a beautiful, atmospheric, mysterious place. And I just thought... You know, I'm always trying to rip off Agatha Christie wherever possible. and I figured that she'd never done a book set in an Oxbridge college. I think because she didn't go to university. So I thought maybe she didn't feel she had the life experience or whatever. So I thought, well, she's not done that. So I'll try and do that. But,
Is it a period piece? Is it in the
But it's very much through that kind of sensibility, I suppose.
Cambridge is kind of timeless.
Yes,
isn't it?
It is. Exactly. It's pretty timeless. And I've read and reread her book so many times, I just sort of tried to just imagine what, if she'd had my life experience, what kind of novel she might write if she set it there.
Well, why don't you just set up the story of The Maidens for us then, Alex? Because obviously there's quite a bit of you in it, I think.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's the same sort of themes that preoccupy me, which are always, you know, the same. So it's sort of, it's like Greek mythology, Greek tragedy, psychology and murder. It's a kind of a mix that works.
The big four, yeah, yeah. Call it, yeah.
So can I just get straight? You're not a murderer, though.
No.
When it says there's
deeply,
a lot of you in it.
Deeply preoccupied in it. Well, frustrated murderer, but like that.
I think all writers are.
It's about a mysterious and charismatic Greek tragedy professor at Cambridge University at a fictional college who is suspected of murdering his students, who are all members of a secret society known as the Maidens. And the heroine is a grieving group psychotherapist who becomes obsessed with proving his guilt. And so it's kind of a story of obsession and, you know, a detective story and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's brilliant. I really loved it.
Oh, thank you.
And
thank
it was such a page turner. I want to come back and talk a little bit more about those characters in a moment. But Charlie, perhaps you can set up your story for us as well and tell us about McIntyre and this whole thing that's happening in Corfu.
My story is about a guy who in this book calls himself McIntyre. He's quite sort of undercover. And he has been hired by a father of a young girl to go to Corfu to kind of free her from the clutches of essentially a paedophile. He's a young tech millionaire guy who has set up his own tennis team of young girls who he trains and teaches. But basically, he's just essentially running a private sex cult in his big mansion on Corfu. And McIntyre has to go in there with a very small team and get the girl out.
And because you obviously write a lot of YA fiction, you must have ideas all the time which either fall in that category or don't. This obviously falls way out of a YA novel. So was it the idea that then drew you back to wanting to write adult fiction, or did you just think, I want to write adult fiction, so I'll come up with an idea?
Well, I'd always wanted to carry on writing adult crime fiction. It was interesting. When I wrote the first four books in the early 90s, crime was not a big thing. In fact, my publishers said, oh, you can't publish these as crime books. They'll just be, you know, that's a sort of grubby backwater. And I said, but these are crime books. I love crime books. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to write. I said, no. We'll make them proper books. So they weren't marketed as well as they could have been. And pretty much as soon as I quit writing crime exploded. It became the biggest thing on the planet and still is. It's funny, as I remember doing a very first event I did for my first book in 1991. Peter James was one of the other writers. And my book was sort of... I think it was on the back of things like Silence of the Lambs. It was sort of pushed into almost horror territory.
Right, okay.
Which was still a bit cool at the time. And Peter James at the time was a big name in horror. And we did an event together. And then fairly soon after that, he got out of horror as quick as he could. Because it just disappeared. And he's now, you know, a massively successful crime author. So I'd always wanted to go back. And, you know, I got sidetracked doing TV and then doing the Young James Bond books and the other books. And it was interesting you talking about where your ideas are coming from, what focus. I find you have a sort of antenna and it's tuned in on whatever you're doing at the time. Mm. So when I was doing a lot of comedy, I was always trying to think of funny ideas for sketches, funny characters. And then, you know, doing the Young James Bond is trying to think of stories and devices that would work in that world. And then horror. And then, you know, I sort of had to retune my adult thing. And it was fun. And it was a release to go back and be able to write about some of the stuff I wasn't able to write about writing for young people. I mean, it's, you know, essentially writing a novel for a teenager, a kid or an adult is the same. You do the same thing. But there's a certain subject matter that you need to steer clear of.
Well, quite.
Mm. Sex cults and things like that.
Yes. Yeah. Those kind of things, exactly. But despite the themes, though, Charlie, you do put the humour in this book still, so that like your comic angle is still there. But it must be quite hard to find the balance, do you think, or not?
Well, I put humour in whatever I'm writing because I think that's how the world works. It's humour in everything we do, and even in the worst situations in the real world, people are still finding humour and laughter. Yeah, sometimes it's black humour, sometimes it's just using humour as a release. And, you know, I think any kind of writing, you know, a book, TV, film, if there's no humour in it, you just think, well, this isn't very realistic.
Yeah.
You know, they would surely laugh if that happened in real life.
Yeah, in real life, surely. At some point, there'd be a little joke.
But yeah, I mean, I like black humour. Mm. And, you know, I'm a big fan of a lot of the pulp fiction, American pulp fiction writers of the 40s, 50s, 60s, particularly Jim Thompson, who was brilliant at using very, very dark, twisted humour in his books. And it makes the nastiness that much more nasty when, you know, if the psychopath is cracking jokes.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I love this book too, Charlie, and I found it equally page-turnery and humorous as I was going through it. And I do want to come back and talk a little bit more about it in a moment. Alex, I said I wanted to talk about your characters a little bit more, and I wondered, because you'd had that Cambridge experience of going to the university there, because maybe it wasn't the greatest, and I wondered how much of the characters are based on the people in your life from that time.
They're not really, actually. No, okay. I think Marianne is probably based on me, the heroine, on the villain, kind of Edward Fosker, the Greek tragedy professor. He's actually based on when I was training as a group therapist, which I also ultimately abandoned that training largely because I encountered this group therapist who was quite toxic and quite mad, and I just stored him in the back of my head for 10 years, and then ended up putting him into a book in a different form. But I guess that's what you do with people, isn't it?
Well, you do. I mean, yeah, you know, as a writer. And people, you know, people occasionally say of some of my books, they say, well, you seem like such a nice person. Well, you do these horrible things in your books. You say, well, that's exactly it. I can put them all in the book so I don't have to kind of do it in real life. Yeah. It's like a sort of portrait of Dorian Gray in some ways, isn't
it? Yes, exactly.
So this guy that you based it on, would you say was a kind of near the top level of psychopath scale?
I'd say he was. You know, it was a really weird situation to kind of be in this training group with him, where I'd had, you know, a lot of experience of individual therapy for many years, and I'd worked in a psychiatric unit and studied it, and had been experienced very supportive, helpful therapy. And yet this man seemed to be, you know, determined to like pick on really vulnerable, damaged people in the group and make them cry. And just, it was, felt very sadistic. Mm. And also it felt that there's something that happens in groups, I think, where people end up regressing to becoming quite young parts of themselves and making the group into their family, and the group leader into their father. Mm. And you just have to look at, you know, politics and history to see what happens when large groups of people place their trust in a complete psychopath.
Well, that's kind of what's at the core of my book, with this cult, essentially a cult leader.
Absolutely.
Does exactly that, of creating a group, playing them off against each other, manipulating them emotionally.
Yes, yeah. And it took, for me, honestly, because I was, you know, a kind of person who just put all of my faith and trust in teachers, it was a real thing for me to actually get up and walk out and not just leave the group, but also leave the training. And it was a moment when I finally grew up, I think. And I just thought, it doesn't matter how many letters you have after your name or how learned you are. If you don't know anything about kindness and humility, you've got nothing to teach me. And it was a big step for me. So it was in the end, it was a traumatic but useful experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have to be careful what you say in case people work out who this guy is?
I wonder. Actually, sometimes I do wonder about that. But we'll see. I'll let you know if I get sued. I'll come back.
And the silent patient took a long old time to write, because obviously, well, initially you didn't even think of it as a book, and it went through various iterations, you know, before mm-hmm. it became this phenomenal bestseller. Was The Maidens a different journey, because you've published a book and it was very successful, and then it's like, right, let's write the other one? Or had you already thought of The Maidens pre The Silent Patient?
No, I hadn't. You know, and it's true, the tricky second album syndrome, it's really true. And that thing that Stephen Fry said about, you know, you've got 36 years or 40 years to write your first book and 6 months to write your second one is really true.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from writing The Maidens, mainly just the fact that I got through the experience of writing a second novel. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. I don't know how you feel about that, but it's a real...
It was a long time ago for me. I'm up to about 22.
Oh my gosh, so, wow, okay.
No, I mean, there was definitely, definitely that experience where you put all your life experiences that are usable into your first one, and then it's like, oh, now what? And looking back on it, and it was quite interesting, one of the things I did in lockdown, one of the jobs you were able to do was recording audiobooks. And I did the audiobooks of my first four novels, which I hadn't read for over 20 years.
Yeah.
I was very pleasantly surprised, actually. I was well prepared to be sitting there thinking, oh, my God, this is awful. But now I got quite involved in them. But it was quite weird looking back at what I wrote for my second book, because it was... I don't really know where it came from.
Did you recognise yourself in it? Did you feel that someone else wrote it?
Well, no, it was interesting because it did, you know, it did reawaken memories of where I was at when I was writing and that kind of thing. But I can't really think of what the impulse particularly was to write the second one. And it wasn't, it doesn't feel like a logical progression from the mm-hmm. first one. Mm.
Well, I love that you went back and did those, because I imagine at the time they'd never been... audio.
No, they weren't a thing at the time. No. You know, who the hell would listen to an audiobook?
No, we were all listening to, you know, Ian Holm on Radio 4, weren't we? Oh, sorry, no, punk rock, that's what I meant.
Yes, no, you're right, Ian Holm. Yeah, well, that was the slight dead hand of Radio 4 afternoon dramas and readings from Book of the Week.
Exactly. That's what I remember as sort of, other than, actually, I listened to books on cassette as a kid. But then it was just Radio 4 Drama, and that was it. That was sort of the audiobook world of the 90s that I remember. So that's brilliant that you went and did that. And probably, well, I'm glad you found it a good experience, because I know many authors would go back and just... You know,
no, I was just thinking, I can't think of anything worse, actually. Than that, but, yeah, that's very brave of you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
In screenwriting terms, Alex, which is obviously where you sort of started your writing career, you don't, it's dialogue really, isn't it? And you don't really get into the heads of characters. They just have to tell you what they're thinking, I suppose, through dialogue. So when you made that change and when you finally did see The Silent Patient as a novel, mm-hmm. was that a sort of nice realization in a way that you could put all that in?
Well, it was lovely because I just found I was better at it.
Yeah.
And it was nice you to say they were successful films. They weren't really. I wrote three films and each one was worse than the last. And I just think that that's partly inherent in the nature of making films, is that everything that can go wrong usually does go wrong. But also just the fact that I wasn't a dramatist, and I realise that now, because the moment I was able to go inside a character's head and just write my first book mainly through the voice of Theo, it was just like a light bulb going off. Mm. I was like, oh, I can do this. I know how to do this. But staging a scene is still very difficult for me, I think.
Right, so there's no plans to go back to screenwriting?
I don't think they'd have me, to be honest. Right.
Even if I knocked on the door, they wouldn't open. But you have you just finished something for TV, Charlie? Or are you working?
I'm in the middle of doing a big TV series. I'm sort of show running out in the Middle East.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is, but as you say, everything can go wrong. Conspires against you, and every day you're kind of chipping another bit off. Oh, we're not going to get that. We're not going to do that. That's not going to work. You do hope that something comes out of it. And I've been lucky that, you know, I've been involved in some things that did go up. But, you know, traditionally when I've been writing for TV, I've done tiny film projects, nothing worth talking about. But for TV, you know, I've been lucky enough to be the producer as well. So you have that control.
Right.
You can't blame anyone else, and you can.
And that's the lovely
on top of the detail.
That's the lovely thing about writing novels, I find, is that I'm because, you know, having been a screenwriter on a film set, I'm the least important person there. Like, you know,
which is madness to me.
Yeah,
but I know that's the way it is. But I always
it's not like that in TV, but on films, very much so. And it's sort of painful a lot of the time because you will say that's not going to work, don't do that, and they'll tell you to shut
up, change
it. And then you'll get a hysterical phone call from the director 6 months later in the editing room saying, "Oh my God, why did you let me do that?" I'm like, well, you know, but when you're writing a book, you're doing everything, you know, you're doing it all, and it's lovely not to be rewritten with that your permission.
You don't have to worry about the budget or whether you're going to get the sets built in time.
Yes,
whether the actors will decide that they would like to play the character completely differently to how you've
written it. Yes, that happens so many times. Yeah.
So you're sort of the writer, director, and producer when you're writing.
You're everything, which you get, you know, in the end, you have to take full responsibility for it. But yes, it's expansive, and you've got huge control, and you've got the time and the space. Script writing is about condensing and squashing it down and cutting it back and making it as tight as possible. So it's a kind of opposite process.
I completely agree. And a friend of mine's a critic, and he said something I thought was so smart. He said that film is about contraction, whereas novels are about expansion. Mm. And that's one of the things I love about writing books, is you can go backwards and forwards in time, and you can go to a character's head, or you can go with them for a walk or whatever, all the kind of thing that you can't really do in film. You know?
Yeah. But do you enjoy that side of it as well? Do you enjoy screenwriting?
I enjoy being able to, you know, not just do one thing all the time, and to switch between them is fun. I mean, you know, the older I get, the harder and more tiring the filming side of things is. Mm. But you can't get away from the fact that unless you have a huge bestseller, you do get paid a lot more in TV. Right.
It's good to know. Yeah. Same with audio, actually. I always ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently. It's a chance to... it's a question I absolutely hate getting asked myself because I never have an answer, so I just put it on everyone else instead. But it's a chance for you to just let us know a few books you might have picked up or authors you've discovered recently and give them a little shout-out. So I know you, Alex, have been over here for a week or so, and you're doing various events and running up and down. But have you had time to read anything?
I have. You know, I'm actually deep into finishing my third book right now, and I don't tend to read many writers when I'm writing because I'm just scared of like nicking ideas or bits of dialogue or whatever.
Do you read non-fiction or just nothing?
I tend to not read when I'm writing, just because you're staring at the screen all day, and the last thing I want to do is then read something. But having said that, there are, you know, a few books that I did read which I really enjoyed. Was Harriet Tice's newest, It Ends at Midnight.
Yep.
I thought was really great and compulsive. And Victoria Selman, Truly, Darkly, Deeply, was a really good analysis of a serial killer and a psychopath. And I don't know how to pronounce her name. I was just asking Emma this. Is it Katrona or Katrina Ward? I'm not sure. But she wrote Sundial.
Katrina Ward.
Is it Katrina? Yeah. I thought she's a brilliant writer. And Sundial, I really recommend to everybody. Yeah,
that's a fab three. And Harriet was on this series, actually, a little earlier, talking about Ends at Midnight. And,
I like Harriet a lot.
She's fab. And that book is brilliant. I mean, I've just raced through that one. What about you, Charlie? You've been reading and enjoying anything recently?
Yeah, yeah. Comes and goes with reading. A few years back, I decided to keep a reading diary. Well, it's a list.
Yeah.
Because, like you, I was always being asked, well, what have you read this year you enjoyed? You think, oh, God, I'm sure I read something, but I can't remember. So I've been writing them down just as an aid memoir. And I seem to average 32 books a year.
Okay, that's pretty good, isn't it?
It's not bad. I mean, you know, some people read like a book a week.
Oh, I know. But I mean, I think 32 books is pretty good.
Yeah, I'm quite impressed with that, I have to say.
Yeah.
Well, I have been, because, you know, I've been through periods of hardly reading anything. I read quite a lot when I'm writing because I like to nick things. You know, also, because, you know, even having written lots of books, you still get stuck. You're thinking, well, how do I do that?
Yeah.
How do I get this person to do this and for the reader to understand what's happening? So you know, I'll read around the sort of, you know, if I'm writing a book with lots of action sequences, I will read how other people do action sequences and things. What have I read recently? Well, you know, we met up at the Chipping Norton Literary Festival.
We did indeed.
Where I met Mick Herron.
Yes.
The first time. It was a lovely guy. And I'd only read the first of his books, Slow Horses, before. And of course, the TV series has done so well. Mm. And meeting him, he was a lovely guy. So I thought, you know, I'm going to carry on reading it. And I'm reading the second one now, and I'm really loving it. I think he's got a great style.
He does. I completely agree. It's quite unique, isn't it, what he does?
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's sort of taking elements of Le Carré, the sort of writing about those kind of complicated losers.
Mm, yeah.
But pushing it more into the sort of slightly outrageous comedy area. I mean, not that they're comedy books. So, yes, I've really loved them. And before that, I read a couple of Mo Hayder books because, well, as you know, she died, and I thought, and there were all these people writing about her, and she was such a fascinating character. I thought I'd better read some of that. Not least the fact that she started out playing Dolly Birds on TV. She was the assistant to old Mr. Grace in Are You Being Served?
Was she?
Yes. You look her up on YouTube.
Mo Hayder?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Wow.
And you know, she was a glamour model. She was all sorts of things in her early days.
Wow.
And under a different name, and sort of put a wall up, and then became, you know, a really strong writer. Yeah. I mean,
and revered.
And but my God, they're quite heavy, violent, and dark. Yeah. So I can't read too many of them in one go.
No, not back to back.
But then I also read, because as I say, I was filming this thing in the Middle East, and it's filming out in the desert. And I went out I took my eldest son out, who's a filmmaker, was interested to see the process. And he's really into this Instagram site that is photographs of directors.
Okay.
Showing us what they look like and what they used to wear.
Okay.
Because most of them we don't know. And he shared with me this amazing picture of John Ford directing Cheyenne Autumn in the desert when he was quite old. The eye patch,
the
slouch hat, this ratty old jumper. And the meanest, nastiest, coldest expression to the camera. And I just thought, I've got to read more about John Ford. I mean, he was a really interesting character. I mean, completely unpleasant in many ways, but fascinating. There's this huge book about him, the author of which I can't remember, which I should do. But fantastic biography of him.
I absolutely love reading biographies now. I never used to, you know, 5 years ago, I wasn't that interested. Now I absolutely love reading them because the ones that are done so well. And in fact, on this very podcast, quite in an early series, David Hepworth was a guest, and his book of choice was The Years of Lyndon B. Johnson, which are like four huge volumes about Lyndon B. Johnson. And I just thought, no, thank you. Yeah. And then he sold it to me so well in the book. I literally went out and bought the first volume. Oh my good! And it's unbelievable. It's not at all. It's not a biography of Lyndon B. Johnson. It's like a history of America. Yeah. You know, it's unbelievable. Yeah. And the same with things like, I imagine, that biography of John Ford. It's like, yes, of course, it's about John Ford's life, but it's also about the entertainment industry and the culture.
A total history of Hollywood. I mean, he started making films during the First World War.
Yeah,
as an actor and a stuntman, and his brother was quite a famous director at the time, and he worked for him.
Yeah,
and then went through that whole Hollywood system, and then went when it was all changing, and he was kind of, young guys were coming up saying, "Who's John Ford?" Never heard of him. And dealing with all that. It's really interesting. I've just looked it up. It's called Searching for John Ford by Joseph McBride.
Brilliant.
And it is a fascinating read.
Fantastic. Some great recommendations there. Mm. And Alex, as a sort of obviously a fan of cinema, and you studied, you went to film school, didn't you?
Yeah.
Are you sort of interested in those old Hollywood biographies as well, even though you're not maybe going back to screenwriting?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to fixate on the same kind of people. So Billy Wilder is what I try to focus on, and Hitchcock mainly.
Right.
Are my favourites. But they were obviously huge fans of Ford. And so, I don't know very much about Ford. I've seen Stagecoach.
Well, I didn't really know much about him as a man. Right. You know, I mean, obviously knew that great legacy of his and had seen a lot of the films. And I did a minor in film studies at university. One of the things I did on that was Western, so we kind of watched a lot of his films. But I knew very little about him as a man and what he was like to work with.
There's a really good book I enjoyed quite recently, or in fact towards the beginning of the old lockdown when I couldn't read fiction, and it was called Chinatown and the End of Hollywood's Golden Age or something. Mm. Again, I'm going to have to look it up now, Charlie, because I can't remember who wrote it. But it's not, it is about China. It's basically about the making of Chinatown, and it's a sort of a bit about Polanski, obviously, and everything that happened there. But it's also so much more than that, because it's about who was coming in and out of the houses and the parties and little side projects that they were doing, you know, that then turn out to be these incredible influential films that we saw in the 70s. And I just sort of love luxuriating all of that. I'll look it up and find out who it is in a moment. But that might be one.
I might enjoy that.
Have you read the Jonathan Coe book, the Billy Wilder one that he did?
No,
it's well worth reading. It's fiction, but
You mean Mr. Wilder and
yes.
Me? Yes. No, I've not read it yet.
And it's a really.
It's going to be a movie now with Christoph Waltz playing playing Wilder. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, that's because
fascinating, because I mean Jonathan Coe obviously loves Billy Wilder.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Have you seen Fedora, the film that is?
I have. I remember going to see it when it came out.
Oh wow! Okay.
And being quite nonplussed.
Totally.
Why would somebody make this film?
I've seen it a couple of times. And I just don't, you know, it's so funny.
The book, although it's fiction, it kind of explains how that film ended up
existing
and why it didn't really work.
Yeah.
Fedora, the one on the island.
That's right.
It's kind of like that old house.
Yeah, it's like a bad remake of Sunset Boulevard.
Now, I quite liked it.
Did you?
Yeah.
It's insane though. You will grow.
I will agree. It's insane, but I was also quite hypnotized by it. I suppose in some way. I saw it at the BFI, which is what, and it was part of a Wilder season. Mm. And I just thought, I've never seen that.
It's a film out of time, really. That shouldn't have been made when it was.
It's so funny. I mean, I'm obsessed with Billy Wilder, and it's so interesting how it's horrifying in a way, because he just lost his ability. He lost his audience somehow, and he just lost his ability to connect with people. And you think, how, when you had your finger on the pulse for so many years,
he got old. You know, that's why the biography of any film director who lived long enough, it gets depressing at the end.
Yeah.
The John Ford is the same. He just was a man out of time, and nobody made films like
in a ratty old jumper.
Or even just stuff like, you know, talking about, you know, documentaries that give a sense of the whole period, is I just watched the Andy Warhol documentary on Netflix, which is all very much about the art scene in the 80s and stuff like that too. But even him, towards the end of his career, he was just saying things like, if only I'd stuck just doing soup cans, I'd still be a hit. I should have done soup cans. And it's so sad to hear someone say that, you know. You just think, but
didn't he also say, when asked about the guy who threw himself out of the factory window, about what he thought about him just being on drugs and falling to his death, he said, "I wish I'd been there to film it." That's one of the things that came from that documentary.
Wonder why nobody said to him, You know, a guy said something very interesting once, Andy. We all have 15 minutes of fame.
I wonder if anyone ever did. That book, by the way, as Tom Through the Glass has just told me very kindly, is called The Big Goodbye. It's by Sam Wasson.
Okay.
The Big Goodbye.
The Big Goodbye, remember that.
Yeah, I recommend that one. Right then, it's time now for the book off, which is where each of you is going to give us another book recommendation. In fact, you're going to have 3 minutes uninterrupted to do so if you wish to have those 3 minutes. You don't have to use them all, but when you get to that 3 minutes, if you're still talking, I'm either going to ring you out with the school bell or I'm going to honk you out with the horn. Who has travelled the furthest? You've travelled the furthest, Alex, haven't you, considering you don't actually live in this country.
So pretend so, yeah.
I'll, you get to choose whether you go first or second.
Do you mind if I go first, just to get it over with?
Is that right? Fine. That's fine. And that means you, Charlie, get to choose whether you have the bell or the horn.
It's going to be both, I think.
He wants the double.
I haven't had time to make it short enough.
That's all right. You'll get both then. Both of you will get both. How about that?
Yeah.
Just before we start the time on your one, Alex, tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
I am doing A Judgment in Stone by Ruth Randall.
Fantastic. All righty then, it's 3 minutes uninterrupted. Over to you, if you want them, to tell us about, don't be nervous, A Judgment in Stone. Off you go.
Okay. I love this book. I don't think I could have written my first novel, The Silent Patient, without it, for all kinds of reasons. It's about a kind of petty blackmailer and murderer called Eunice Parchment, who can't read or write and is taken into a kind of upper middle class family as their housekeeper and is determined to keep her literacy a secret from them. But they keep, because they're a very literate kind of family, they keep kind of pushing her to a place where the fact that she can't read or write is discovered. And she then kind of descends into madness and she kills them. And that's like, you know, great Ruth Rendell territory. What elevates it and makes it into a really spectacular novel is the narrative voice, which keeps intruding on the story and commenting on the characters. And it starts with the very famous opening line, which is, Eunice Parchment killed the Coverdale family because she could not read or write. That's just so amazing because, you know, she gives away the end of the book at the beginning. And so not only did she kind of elevate it into a tragic kind of sphere, it's also incredible because it's so audacious. And you just think, how the hell is she going to match that? Well, where does the story go now? She told us the end. And so there's something about knowing the end of the beginning and the fact that she keeps commenting all of the characters. It becomes a kind of really haunting story of a descent into madness and a march towards death, and she keeps highlighting all the things the characters could have done differently to avoid their fate, and yet they don't. And so you read it with an increasing sense of anxiety and you know, unease. I think I've learned so much from that book. I've read it, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And I took the first line from The Silent Patient. It was kind of a homage to that, which was Alicia Barrison killed her husband when she was 33 years old, because I just thought it's a really fun way to start a detective story, is say whodunit. And then kind of explore that. And so, you know, Ruth Rendell for me is kind of like, I've graduated from Christie to Ruth Rendell, yeah. I think. She's just the most sophisticated, brilliant writer ever.
Fantastic! Oh, well, you didn't need the 3 minutes at all.
I'm glad I made 2 minutes. I'm quite
nice
impressed
and
with that,
succinct
actually.
There with
can I have his fair second?
Yeah. Oh, we've never had a trade-off before. Yeah, I'm not sure that's allowed. Don't be too nice. Don't be too nice, Alex. That was brilliant. We'll come back and talk about Ruth in just a moment. Have a rest, have a breather, have some more water. 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Charlie. And just before we start it, what book are you putting forward?
I'm going with From the City, From the Plough by Alexander Barron.
Fantastic. All right, then. 3 minutes on the clock. Over to you.
OK. Alexander Barron was a really interesting writer. He was the son of Jewish immigrant parents who grew up in Hackney in the East End. He was a communist in the 30s, like most bright young men were. Became disillusioned with the left in the Spanish Civil War and then fought in the Second World War. Two very violent campaigns in Sicily, and he was involved in the D-Day landings and fighting up through Europe. And after the war, he wrote several novels about the war, but he also wrote quite a lot of crime books about the East End and became a screenwriter in the UK and Hollywood.
and eventually ended up doing a lot of work for the BBC with things like Play for Today and Poldark and Sherlock Holmes and Dickens adaptations. He was a very strong, reliable writer. From the City, from the Plough, published in 1948, and it's about a group of soldiers, junior officers and you know, enlisted men, getting ready, although they don't know it, to for the D-Day landings. And it's the bulk of the book is about the sort of mundanity of what it was like for a soldier at the time, and the fascinating details, you know, the fact that many of the soldiers, they would desert regularly. They'd go off to Soho, do a bit of gambling, join themselves, sorting out family problems. And then when they'd run out of money, they'd just go back to the army and be locked up for a few days and carry on, because the army needed, particularly at this time, all the soldiers it could get. And that whole sort of process of getting them ready and pushing them through for the campaign. There's a really interesting section where they're all on the Isle of Wight, and just the amount of time it took to load thousands of men onto boats, and then they were sitting on the boats. And what it brought home to me was that for most people in the UK, life was going on as normal. And so there's all these people, holidaymakers in the Isle of Wight, who are really pissed off that all these kind of drunken squaddies have taken over the island. And, it reminds you that the Blitz was over, life was carrying on. But for these young men, they're not professional soldiers by this time in the war. And it follows them through. It follows a whole group of them, and then it goes into the carnage of D-Day, and particularly the period after that, where they're just driven on and on and on to keep fighting and keep pushing forward. And the dehumanising aspect of that, in that, you know, you would think the officers would say, well, you know, you've done your bit, take a rest. It's like, no, you carry on until there's none of you left, and then we'll put the next wave through. And it's a very moving book, but completely unsentimental. You do get involved with all these characters, and, you know, some of them are nuts and some of them are quite nasty, but they're just ordinary young men.
Wow. I know you had more to say there, but you brought it in.
That's a bit where the aliens land.
Oh, I love that incredibly, like, actorly way that you just finished that off anyway, knowing that the time was up. That was brilliant. Wow. Two very different books and two fabulous pictures. I love the sound of both of these. I haven't read either of them, actually. In fact, I'm probably woefully underread in general, but also with Ruth Rendell. She's not someone I've actually read possibly anything of, actually.
Oh, it's her best novel. I really recommend
it. Yeah, I mean, it sounds fab. And I know that she... just to age me a little bit, I remember watching telly as a kid and it often being based on the novel by Ruth Rendell. Do you know what I mean? Like, that used to come up a lot on those.
Well, what she did often, you know, was write these procedurals. And, I've read pretty much everything she's written now. And I can often find them a bit thin and hard to get through sometimes. Uh-huh. And they haven't aged well. But the ones where she is narrating it, you know, where she allows her personality to kind of invade the novel, like a Judgment Stone, they're so powerful because she's so funny and so acidic. Mm. And so they're kind of elevated to a whole new level.
So that wasn't a Barbara Vine?
It wasn't a Barbara Vine, but it could have been. It was a long time before she started writing Barbara Vine, but it should have been a Barbara Vine. It's that vibe, definitely.
Because
I've
definitely preferred the Barbara Vine side of her writing, which that sounded completely like.
Me too.
Like getting into, again, it's what we were talking about earlier, getting inside a mind.
A head, yeah.
And exactly that the character in the book, obviously to herself, the only way she could sort a situation, the logical thing to do, to kill these people.
Yes, and then make a cup of tea.
Yes.
That's what she does, and that's my favourite bit in the book. Yeah. It's just brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah. I also love that, obviously, this, it means a lot to you in the sense that you say, you know, you possibly couldn't have written that debut novel without it. The audacity of that, giving away the whole plot in the first line, and which possibly at that time, you know, probably wasn't a thing that people did really, and then making you go, okay, right, well, you've sort of told me, but I want to keep reading. Yeah. I just think it's brilliant.
It's really incredible.
It sounds fascinating. As does From the City, From the Plough. Again, I don't think I knew of Alexander Baron. Maybe I should have.
The book has been in print ever since. It was a big bestseller at the time. And what's interesting about it is it feels incredibly modern when you read it.
Mm.
It feels like a book that's written by someone as a sort of revisionist look at what it was like. But no, that was exactly how it was. And at the time, nobody was saying, oh, you know, he's making a point or this is what it was like. It was like, yes, this is what it was like. And I'm sure Steven Spielberg must have read it before he met, when he was researching Saving Private Ryan. Yeah. Not so much for the actual landings bit, but for that whole thing of pushing on afterwards.
And,
you know, the Tom Hanks character feels very similar to a couple of the characters in the book, these guys who have come from a fairly ordinary background, but now they're in a position where they're looking after men. Mm. And, you know, you can see he's very sort of psychologically damaged, but he just has to keep going.
Well, there's a few things that stuck out for me from that wonderful pitch. One is how it's moving, but unsentimental. You know, just that idea of it. Yes, you are moved by it, but at the same time, it's just like, hey, this is what happened, you know. Mm. But then this idea that, like you say, life was going on. People a little bit annoyed, holidaymakers annoyed at this drunkenness, whereas it's all these men, young men, were being pushed to basically being, as you said, like dehumanised and then moving on, you know. Oh. And it's like, God, that really, just even hearing you say that makes me think, goodness me. And then, you know, I imagine actually reading it and from that time as well. It's
and the other really interesting thing about the book is despite the fact that he was, you know, he'd been a communist, he was still pretty left-wing, and he was Jewish. There's virtually nothing about the Germans in the book. There's no sense of we're going to go and kill these evil bastards. They are the enemy. It's just like, we're a bunch of young men. We're going over there. We're going to do what we're told.
Yeah.
There's no feeling of, I really want to kill them, if they ever thought about it. Cause I remember talking to my father-in-law who went through the D-Day thing. You know, he said, you very rarely saw the enemy. You tried not to kill any of them. And when you saw the dead bodies, you just thought, well, they look like young men, exactly like us. I hope it wasn't my bullet that killed him, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well,
God. It's just, I mean, it sounds absolutely fascinating. And also, for me personally, I don't know if I've read enough and watched enough about, you know, the wars and about
I'm not one of those sort of Second World War buffs.
No, me neither.
Tank document.
No. Things. But even just in general, I wouldn't normally read it.
A friend recommended it, and you know, it's one of those books I just sort of recommend to everyone.
Mm. Well, they're both fabulous sounding books, both brilliant pitches. Gosh,
how do you decide? They couldn't be more different.
They couldn't be more different, could they? Really? Well. It's a good question, really. I mean, let's not pick apart the whole, idea process. Of the podcast. I'm going to take the Alexander Baron.
Hey.
I'm going to take the Alexander Baron because I feel like I need to know more about it, and I feel like this is the book that would tell me and teach me quite a bit. Having said that, I've got to read. Well, maybe I don't have to read so much Ruth Rendell, but I need to read this one.
No. Honestly, the non Police ones are great.
Okay.
Really interesting books.
So I'm going to start with The Judgment in Stone, I think, because
I think you'll love it.
That was a great pitch. And I might have to get you to write down a few others that I should follow that up with as well. And, of course, Barbara Vine.
Yes.
Barbara Vine as well. Thank you for those brilliant pitches and recommendations. And here's two others for you. Whatever Gets You Through the Night by Charlie Higson, which is out now and it's published by Little Brown. And The Maidens by Alex Michaelides. It's also out now and it's published by Orion. And they're both fabulous, as are you two. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks for the recommendations. And it's been lovely spending this time with you.
Yeah, thank you too. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.